What a wonderful change in my life has been wrought since Jesus came into my heart. I have light in my soul for which long I have sought since Jesus came into my heart. I have ceased from my wandering and going astray since Jesus came into my heart. And my sins, which were many, are all washed away since Jesus came into my heart. And I'm happy, so happy as onward I go since Jesus came into my heart. And I'm sure there are a great many people on the online. And by the way, this is going to drive me crazy. This little caller just wants to play pop-up this morning, so let me get that fixed real quick. And I'm sure there are a lot of people online right now. They're like, oh my gosh, Barry actually found the hymnal. I knew where they were. They're in the pew rack where they always are. But that song just kind of fits where we're headed for the next few weeks. Last year at this time, we were in a sermon series called Wonder Women of the Bible. And in that series, we took a look at five women from the Old Testament whose faith was actually the foundation of our faith. However, their stories often go untold. And just so you know, I got a lot of great feedback off of that. A lot of people liked it. It is still one of our most popular sermon series that gets picked up on YouTube and watched. And it's also one of the most popular sermon series that have been downloaded, and you see other people kind of using the same. You do realize ministers were thieves. We steal from one another all the time. And so I steal my ideas from people, and people steal other ideas. And it's not that we just borrow them. We're allowing the Holy Spirit to let us borrow these things. And so this is a very, very popular series. But the truth is, ministers are also one of these kind of these people that once something works once, we attempt to go back and catch lightning in the bottle twice. And well, the sermon series we're about to start is not an attempt to do that. It is actually going to draw some parallels as we're going to look at some lives of women that are found in the New Testament now. But this sermon series is about the idea of living faith. And again, I want to go back to the church of Ephesus. This is where we ended our last year, and I've actually pulled this church into the sermon series that we've been doing this year, and we will continue to pull them into this because it's important that we realize this concept of living faith. And what you need to remember is that this church in Ephesus was a very good church. I do not want you to forget that. They were a very good church. However, while they were a very good church, they were not a very purposeful church. They were doing many things, but in the process of doing many things, they had lost something. What they had lost is they had lost their first love for Jesus, and make no bones about it, Jesus says, you know what, find it, or you're not going to survive. Thus, we find out that if we're truly going to have this idea of living faith, this faith is more than just coming together and doing things and being a church, we're going to have to figure out how to re-fall in love with Jesus. So that's what we have been attempting to do, and that's what this year is all about. And we're kind of right in this little section of sermons that are going to focus right on Jesus. So we just finished up the Easter experience, which kind of stepped into who is Jesus, and it talked about Jesus' sacrifice and all the things that he went through, and it helped force us to answer that question, what are we going to do with this Jesus? So today we're going to start this idea of the day I met Jesus. I'll get to that in a little bit more, but when this one is done, we're going to still be talking about Jesus. We're going to go talk about the Father of the Bride, and then we're going to go listen to some Jesus tweets. If Jesus had a Twitter account, what would he say on that account? Good news is we already know, because he had a Twitter account. We just call it the Bible. But this particular sermon series is all about the day I met Jesus. Now, I want to give you some history on where this sermon series came from. You know how when you go to Amazon and you buy books or you buy something, and as you're checking out, they have the you may also like section, because they're trying to get you to buy more books and more things. And well, as last summer when we were preparing to go on vacation, I bought a couple of books to take with me. And as I was checking out, there was this book by Frank Viola and Mary DeMuth that they offered me at a discounted price that I could take with me, and it was called The Day I Met Jesus. The book is based on five women in the Gospels that had a life-changing meeting with Jesus. And to just let you know, I picked the book up, and I really wasn't expecting much from it. It was kind of one of those things, I'll get to it eventually. And I started reading it, and it became the first book that I finished in my little stack that I got to take on vacation with me. And it gave me the idea for this sermon series. Now, just so you know, this is not going to be an exact study of the book, obviously. This is going to be a four-week study, and there are five ladies mentioned in that book, so obviously we're going to do one lady less. That would be the woman in the well, at the well. We covered her story really well last year. Also, even when you begin to take this series apart, I'm not doing the same women that they're doing. So it's based on, you know, they may say it's based on a true story. It's based on the idea behind the book, because we do want to tell the stories as we remember that we need to, like Ephesus, remember the day that we met Jesus. You know, we start talking about meetings, and there's a meeting that changed my life. Jesus was the one that changed my life most, but there was another one day. It was a girl, and her name at the time was Deborah Elizabeth Davidson. And by the way, I'm at a safe distance. She's on the other side of the camera. She can't even give me one of those dirty looks for sharing a story that I didn't get permission to share before I'm sharing it. But that's okay. I'll ask forgiveness when I get home. But Deborah and I met, and the day we met was at a department store. She worked there, and she worked with the mother of my best friend. And the mother of my best friend asked my best friend to get me to go over to the store and meet Deborah in hopes that maybe we would start going out together. And you know how it goes, and everybody tells you, yeah, go meet this girl. You're like, no. But you know what? Decided to take a chance, and so went on over to what was then Hieronymus, which is not there anymore, and we met. And you know what? We're still together. Isn't that kind of cool? That's been 1994 was when we met, and we're still together. And the funny thing is, no matter how long our relationship goes, every now and then we go back and we tell that funny story, and when I'm really trying to be sarcastic, I say, yeah, I found my wife in a sale rack there at Hieronymus. Again, notice she's not here. I'm at a safe distance. And so this series is all about this idea of the very first meeting for these ladies. As a matter of fact, this is where their story ends. Their story begins at this first meeting, and their story is going to end at this first meeting. So where do we start? How about here?
Have you ever made a mistake? I'm not talking about a small mistake, but a big one. One so terrible that you can't even look someone in the face and tell them what you did. I could see the rocks in their hands, their fists raised high in the air. I had sinned, and I got caught. And the punishment for the sin that I committed? Death. The religious leaders, or the Pharisees, brought me before the crowd. These men know everything about God's law, or at least they think they do. I was terrified. I couldn't even look up. I just knew any second the first rock would be thrown, and that would be it. Then I heard the Pharisees ask Jesus if I deserved to die. I had heard about Jesus. Heard that he healed the sick and made blind men see. But Jesus said nothing. I just saw him bend down and write something in the sand. But the Pharisees still kept demanding an answer. My heart was pounding in my chest. I thought, this is it. He's going to end up agreeing with them, and I am going to die. But Jesus just kept writing in the sand. But then spoke. He said, let any of you who have never sinned throw the first stone. Did I hear that correctly? Did Jesus just defend me? Me, of all people. I thought I heard the crowd walking away, but I was too afraid to look up. Then he spoke to me. Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you? No, Lord. Neither do I, he said. Go and sin no more. Jesus stepped up and defended me. Me. And when I looked into his eyes, all I could see was love. Instead of feeling ashamed, I felt loved. I felt free. And the only one who could have ever done that is Jesus. And he can do the same for you. Oh, how he loves you. No matter what you've done, Jesus' love can cover all your sin and shame. I know, because his love did it for me.
John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law of Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now what do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis to accuse him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with this woman, still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin." We read the story, and very often we have a very obscured focus of this particular story. It's familiar. As a matter of fact, this isn't the first time that I've preached a sermon on this particular section from the Bible here in this church. Usually this story is preached toward the religious people. It's to warn us against the idea of judgment. You see, it talks about their motives were impure. It talks about they were not interested in justice but judgment. They were there to trap Jesus. They were there to outsmart Jesus. That's the story that we usually tell when we come to these verses. But maybe that's not the story we should tell. Many times when we talk about this story, we try to fill in the cracks. We love to do that, right? I mean, we got to know all about these people. And so we try to begin answering questions. Questions like, who was she? Was she a habitual sinner, or was this a first-time thing? What about the man that was supposed to be there with her? I mean, after all, you can't be caught in adultery by yourself. That's impossible. We want to answer these questions, and in our telling, you know what begins to happen? The woman in the story begins to get lost. Just like the Pharisees, we can be guilty of making her a pawn in her own life. And folks, that's unfortunate. Because this story, this day, is the day she met Jesus. It is by far the most important day of her life, and it gets lost in a religious event. It is the most significant event in her existence, and folks, we miss it because we begin to look at the big picture instead of focusing on her. Well, I'm pleased to tell you, not this time. This sermon is all about those last little parts of this particular section of Scripture, verses 9 through 11, and everybody's breathing a sigh of relief. We're not going to try to cover 11 verses in the sermon. We're going to actually just cover 2. And we're going to break them apart, and we're going to begin looking at them, because usually these verses, they're part of the conclusion in the sermon. You know, we preach all the other fun stuff and all the stuff we want to talk about, and then we kind of use these. But you know what? I don't want to do the normal. I want to take these verses, and these verses are the sermon as we begin looking at the idea of the day this woman met Jesus. And how does it start? Well, it starts with no one but her and Jesus. This is what it says. Until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and asked her. I love the clip that I was showing because it showed some of the emotion. I mean, you can almost see it, right? As the people begin to go and Jesus begins to look at her, I bet her heart is racing. It's beating a little bit fast. Maybe her eyes are clenched shut and her body has become rigid. After all, she's expecting to get pelted with a stone. Maybe she begins to hear the thud of those stones, but they're not hitting her. They're hitting the ground. The crowd has grown quiet, and she can hear the shuffling of feet and the murmuring of the voices. What's happened? And then as she finally works up the courage, and she opens her eyes, and she begins to look, and she was expecting to be dead at this point. They're all gone. All except for this one man. And you know, the funny thing is, while this is the day she met Jesus, she probably heard of him before. Perhaps she'd even taken in a lesson or two. Maybe witnessed some miracles. He's there, and when she first sees him, he's still drawing on the ground. Funny, that's one of the things that often distracts us. What is he drawing? What is he writing? Doesn't matter. How do I know? Because the Bible doesn't tell me what he was drawing or what he was writing. What should I do is probably running through her head. Should I say thank you? I mean, after all, he just saved my life. He just agreed. He just sent these people away. Should I do the awkward stroll and just kind of back away nice and quiet, say, have a nice day, sir. Grateful for you, Rabbi. Maybe I should get up and run. I mean, what happens if he decides to throw a stone? I mean, you need to remember, I am 100% guilty of what they said I did. This isn't an idea of whether or not I had sinned. I did sin. And yes, God's law said that I must die. And you know, this is important for us to remember. Because this idea of meeting Jesus, this idea of falling in love with Jesus all over again, it's important that we remember, if we're going to be in love with Jesus, you have to do it one-on-one. Isn't this one of the things that we get upset about in our marriages or our other relationships? I have no time. I have too many other things to do. Where's my one-on-one time? What happened to my dating relationship? What happened to us being just together? But we know how it goes. We get more things going on in our life, and we don't have as much time as we used to have for the relationship. And this being alone with Jesus can sound awful, awful, awful scary. Because oftentimes, let's be honest, I like the busy. One of the reasons I hate this coronavirus thing is because they've isolated me to my house. And guess what? I have too much time to think now. I've got time on my hands. I've never had time on my hands. I always keep my life busy. I run from one thing to the next, and I never have to sit and think. See, I like the crowd because it keeps me busy. It keeps me distracted. I don't have to come to grips with who I am in this relationship and who he is. But I find it interesting, Jesus did not try to give this woman her lesson with the crowd away. He had to what? Get rid of the crowd first. and now it was just her and him. See, this wasn't the day that they met Jesus. This is the day she met Jesus. This is the day she's going to learn something about who Jesus is. And as most of the time happens, it starts with a conversation. And I want to read the conversation to you. It's not a long conversation. Jesus straightened up and asked her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No, sir, she said, then neither do I condemn you. Now, we're talking about a three-sentence conversation, four if you count that last sentence that we're going to talk about in just a minute. And so you're probably wondering, how much could I possibly learn from such a very short little conversation? I mean, all the other topics are a lot more interesting, and they're a lot bigger. And the truth is you can learn a whole bunch. You can learn much about this particular conversation if you learn to focus on the key word. And that key word, it's condemned. And when you look that word up, it means sentenced to a particular punishment, especially death, or officially declared unfit for use. That's the conversation was going back and forth between Jesus and the woman. Didn't they condemn you? No, they didn't condemn me. Well, then neither did I condemn. This whole word about being condemned. Now, the question becomes, what condemned the woman to start with? And it's important that we pay attention, because what condemned her? Her actions. Again, there was no doubt about her guilt. She knew what she was doing. She was 100% sure that what she was doing was not what God had asked her to do. It was exactly what it was. It was sin. And her actions now brought her to this situation. Think about it. If she had not been doing what she was doing, then nobody would have ever caught her doing what she was doing, so now she would not be where she is for doing what she did. Her actions had put her in this situation. But her actions weren't the only thing that condemned her. See, there was a who that condemned her also. And who condemned this woman? Her accusers. They had examined her life to a standard. And the good news is they had actually examined her life to a standard given to us in Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10. If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress are to be put to death. So they were using God's word as a standard. And I guess that's a good start. If they were going to just use the law, then yes, she absolutely, positively had to die. But that was Jesus' point. If you're going to go strictly by the law, guess what? All of us deserve to die. When James wrote his book in the Bible, we had that verse that is just one of those things I cling to. Guilty of one, guilty of all. Your sin is no better or no worse than my sin. You struggle with this, I struggle with that. But in God's eyes, it's all the same. Sin is sin. And that's the point that Jesus is driving here. You who have never sinned, go ahead. Pick up the rock. Hurl away. You have the right. You do. But the funny thing is who did not condemn this woman? Who was it? Well, the answer is, quite frankly, Jesus. And that's the important thing, because Jesus set the standard for who could condemn this woman. It had to be somebody that had committed no sin. And in that crowd, there was one. There was only one person there that had the right and the authority to hurl a rock at this woman and say, you know what, you deserve to die. And that was Jesus. He had set it up in such a way that it was his choice whether she lived or died. And here's the important thing that you need to remember. Jesus did not come to condemn the sinner. And you know, I've said that a bunch of times from this pulpit over the years. And sometimes I still don't think it registers. How do I know? because I listen. And as I listen, we still want to talk more about people's sin than we do about God's grace. We're trying to make a checklist of who's in and who's out of heaven. Ironically, whenever I make a checklist, you know who's always in? Me. I always set the standard where I'm okay. We have more interest in preserving tradition for the sake of tradition instead of loving people the way God loved them. You see, I'm not making a judgment call when I say we struggle with this idea of not wanting to condemn people. It's just a fact. And if you listen, you can hear it. But what I'm hoping today is lay the groundwork where you can maybe hear something else, especially if you're a first-time guest with us. If you're new to hanging out here at Parkview Christian Church, I want you to see something this morning. Because when Jesus met this woman, he introduced her to an entirely new concept when it came to dealing with sin. And this concept is the one that is so important to us if we're going to have true living faith. And we can find it in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 16. This is what it says. Let us approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. What are the new concepts that Jesus was going to teach? Well, the first one he's going to teach is mercy. Mercy is compassion or forgiveness shown towards someone whom it is who is within one's power to punish them. What a definition. Because mercy is something that we receive. And this idea of mercy is it covers this idea of judgment with brand new words. Compassion and forgiveness. This thing called mercy, it means that I no longer look for a way to condemn you. I look for a way to bestow compassion upon you, to love you, and to forgive you. You see, Jesus was totally justified in killing this woman. She had sinned, and he had not. But mercy says, stop. I'm not going to give you what you deserve. Mercy tells us that, you know what? It's all about what you need, not what you deserve. Now, the thing that you need to understand about mercy when you look in the chapter of Hebrews is mercy is an event. Think about it for just a second. At the moment Jesus let her go, she had received her mercy. Say that again because I want you to see it really clearly. At the moment when Jesus said, go, leave, walk away. Mercy had been given. She didn't need any more mercy. She didn't need it at all. But you see, mercy has this other agent that has to work with it. And the other agent is called grace. What is grace? Well, as you look through the dictionary, the word has picked up a lot of baggage over the years. If you want to take the time, and you have time on your hands, so you can go get a dictionary, you can go on Google, and you can look up the meaning of grace, and you'll actually find out that it has six different definitions, including one is the name of a female name. But the dictionary amongst those six, I actually found it funny because they have a Christian definition of grace listed in the dictionary. And here's what it is. In the Christian belief, the free and unmerited favor of God as manifest in the salvation of sinners and bestowal of blessings. Man, I love that definition. I think I might want to get it engraved on something or hang it somewhere because this is exactly what God had in mind when he said grace. Note the three parts that our friends that wrote the dictionary gave us. It's unmerited. I don't earn it. I don't deserve it. It's got a focus. It is supposed to save the sinner. And it's got a second focus. After we are saved, it's supposed to bestow blessings. And when Jesus gave her grace, what his words were, go now and leave your life of sin. Now, this is a tricky verse to deal with because depending on the translation, you can get very different ideas. In the video I showed you and in a lot of translations, what you get is go and sin no more. And when I hear that, I kind of think that's ironic because Jesus is commanding something that's impossible. If I follow the idea that this is just about me never committing another sin, I got my mercy, and now I have to live sin-free, then you know what? The next time I sin, it's all gone. What happens the next time I'm standing in front of the rock throwers? What happens the next time that I messed up? What happens the next time that I didn't think it all the way through? And so when I think about this idea of grace and this idea of mercy is just giving me a pass on this particular sin and passing me back down my life and saying, now go try again to live perfect, then I just have to keep running back looking for more mercy. And I get to the idea of, what good is that? It puts me on an endless treadmill of trying to be good enough for God. And as I try to be good enough for God, I quickly find out I can't be good enough for God. And so then I have to deal with the idea, okay, so now what do I do? And eventually I just get tired of it. I get tired of trying to walk a treadmill life and trying to live it that way. And then I come back to this idea of mercy as far as Hebrews and the way Hebrews put it out there. This is why I love that verse in Hebrews chapter 4, because mercy is not something we receive. Mercy is something we receive, but grace is something we have to discover. Isn't that what it says? Grace is something that I have to find. So mercy, God gives me. Grace, I have to go find it. And as I begin to think about that, I'm like, cool, I like scavenger hunts. I'm kind of good at them. I don't mind doing the detective work. Where do I find grace? You're never going to believe the answer. I find grace in my sinful life. I'm 51 years old. I accepted Christ when between my 11th and 12th birthday. So you can either call me 11 or 12. I don't know. You can pick. So I've been doing this for 40 years. And you know what I figured out? The longer I've attempted to live my Christian life, what I figured out is I can't live my Christian life. Why? Because I keep sinning. I still struggle with sin. As a matter of fact, I still struggle with some of the same sins that I was struggling with when I was 11 or 12 years old. You would think I would have outgrown them by now. You would think that I should be able to stop and kick the habit. And you know what happens? I get caught back on the treadmill. I'm living my Christian life, and everything is going good for a few minutes, maybe a day. Maybe I make a week if I'm having a really great week, and then I get to that point, and I lose it, and I sin. And you know what happens when I do? I go back to God, pleading for more mercy. And you know what happens? His answer is always the same to you. You don't need more mercy. I've given that to you. We celebrated the crucifixion when we took the Lord's Supper. And you understand, Jesus is not going back to the cross. Jesus is not going to go back and be crucified all over again simply because I can't get it right. You see, God looks at me and says, remember, mercy is an event. There is one time that I have to show you mercy. And that one time was when I hung on a cross and I died for your sins. And the moment you've accepted that, you have received mercy. But now I have to keep dealing with my sinful life. And well, what God tells me is my grace means we now walk together, gradually leaving your sinful past, your sinful life in the past. You just feel like maybe that weight that was on your shoulders just got lifted. I mean, I hear those words, go and sin no more, and I'm like, I can't do that. I'm probably not even going to make it to my truck when we're done here, and I don't have but five people here. I can't do it. But now I find out that the idea of grace is not an event. The idea of grace, it's a process. The idea of grace is as I begin to sin and as I deal with my sin, I go running back to God. He says, okay, I get it. I get it. You need something that goes along with the idea of mercy, because I'm not going back to the cross, but I've got something for you, and it's called grace. Now, I want to make sure I say this, because as I am preaching this, somebody's going to be like, cool. So I can accept Christ and receive my mercy, and then I can go out and live my life any way that I want it, and I can keep sinning, and God's grace will just keep flowing and flowing and flowing, and I never have to change anything. Man, what an awesome way that would be. No, you've missed the point. You see, when I do get to the idea of I am covered by grace, Paul tells us that, he paints a fantastic picture in Romans chapter 6. He actually talks about himself. Remember, this is the Apostle Paul, the guy that writes all of these scriptures. He seems to know everything there is to know about the Bible and everything there is to know about Jesus and everything there is to know about the church. And we base so much of what we believe off of what Paul says. And well, here he actually outlines the idea how he's schizophrenic. He's got two natures, and these two natures are doing battle with inside of him. And he comes out right, and he admits that oftentimes the sin side wins the battle. And, well, he says a surrender. He sins. And while he does surrender to the sin at the moment, he does not surrender to his sinful life. And you know what? As Jesus told the woman, Paul desires to leave his sinful life behind him. See, there's the point. The point is that to receive grace, you have to be willing to leave your sinful life behind you. There has to be an idea that, you know what, I'm not just sitting and running back to God and trying to get my ticket punched again. I actually want to leave it behind me. See, if you have received God's mercy, you have also received his spirit, and that means, you know what, you're not just only human anymore. A lot of times that's how we treat our sin. I'm only human. I still do that. I'm only human. And he says, no, you're not just human. You're something much more. When you accept Christ, because it says, I give you my spirit. I walk along with you. It's interesting, Jesus told the woman to go and sin no more, but the woman didn't have to go. She could have stayed right there with Jesus. She could have allowed him to be more than just a chance meeting on this one day. She could have walked in his grace and not just received his mercy. So do I live a perfect life? Absolutely. Positively, no. I don't live this Christian life perfectly. And you know what? Neither will you. But every time I stumble and fall and I run back to God, and he says, my grace is sufficient, let's try again. But you do see that part of this, right? Every time I fall, I keep running back to God. This is why I love David, because David, man, the sins were immense, but every single time David came face to face with his sin, he came running back to God. God forgave him and said, my grace is sufficient. You see, under Christ, I am never condemned for my sin, but I am always expected to leave it behind. And when I fall short, Jesus says, grace. And I think about that concept, and I'm like, you know what? That grace costs an awful lot. Because every time Jesus has to give a little bit of grace, we do have to go back to the cross. Not that he hangs on it again, but we have to go back to what gave us the original idea of mercy. And so as I begin to think about this idea of Jesus, the question I have to begin to ask myself is, have I met this Jesus? You know what, I met the real Jesus, the one that was taught to me very well as I was growing up, where there were these lists of rules and regulations and checklists and things that we're supposed to do, things you aren't supposed to do, how you're supposed to live a successful life. And you know what? that Jesus is a hard Jesus to follow. I can't do it. I can't go and sin no more. But today I want to ask you, have you met the Jesus of grace and mercy? He was the only one there that never condemned that woman. He was the only one there that allowed her to experience mercy and grace. But you know what the truth is? There was only one person there that could accept it. That was the woman. She could have been so overridden with her own guilt, she could have thrown rocks at herself. She could have not dealt with her issue. She could have refused to accept it. But she chose to follow Jesus, at least at this point. Her story is going to end. How about yours? Have you met Jesus in a way that you've experienced his grace and mercy? I'm going to pray. Then we're going to do a closing song, and our time of worship will end.